I'm Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University of Malta. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing the many research projects undertaken by the university's academics from all fields of study. I'm very happy to have with me today on Research Matters, Professor Charles Poulet from the Department of Electronic Systems Engineering. Professor Poulet was educated at De La Salle Brothers in Tonnerre and then joined the dockyard in Malta. He was transferred to Chatham Dockyard, where he remained for 7 years, working on armaments and, I understand, other secret machinery. He then went to study for his undergraduate degree and read for his PhD as well at the University of Newcastle, where he says he debated regularly with characters such as Harold Wilson and Ian Shinwell and Roger Bannister. Sounds very exciting. On his return to Malta, he started lecturing at MCAST at that time and worked as a consultant to industry, and at the same time lectured at the University of Malta. He was also a court expert and for some years was consultant engineer to the Gozo Ferry, keeping the ships afloat, and also worked at St. Luke's Hospital with the complex medical machinery used there. His chief specialisation is actually communications. When he worked at the dockyard, he tells me he was dealing with secret coding and deciphering machinery. He comes from a family of traditional boat builders from the Victoriosa Kalkara area. He's now been lecturing here at the university for many years at the Faculty of Engineering. Welcome, Professor Poulet.
Thank you.
My first encounters with you when I started working within the rectorate at the university was in the early 90s. You'd stop by my desk on the way in and out, perhaps, of Father Peter's office and talk about some philosophical idea that you were reading about, or perhaps to ask my opinion about an article for the media or something like that. And you struck me as being one of that rather rare breed that manages or likes to straddle the arts and the sciences. And certainly, I think you taught me to look at a piece of industrial design with new eyes. Your idea of what is beautiful was not appreciated by me at that time, because I had never looked at a sort of a crankshaft as an object of beauty. But you taught me to do that. So now, in fact, I when I look at a piece of machinery, I really remember your words. And do you remember trying to inculcate that idea in me?
Yes, I remember that very well. Well, you see, many people think that the universe is made of objects, isolated objects. And many people think that languages are made of words, which describe the object. It is not like that. The universe is made of relations. It is the relations within the object or external to the object that actually makes the object. So it is the relations that we need to think about, because the object can be seen by any animal. But an animal cannot relate the object, so even the language is not words. If you learn words, you cannot do much with them. For example, if you say cat, dog, and a chair, well, okay, those are the objects. But if you say the cat and the dog are on the chair together, you can relate them in a different way. You can say the cat is on the chair and the dog is tied in the corner. So although you have the same object, the relations are different. So when you come to art and a shape, whatever it may be, the shape, it could be a sports car, it could be a person, it could be a decoration in a house, a church, whatever, architecture, I found that the relations could be emotional, it could be physical, it could be... So I decided to look into it and decide to relate how certain emotions are captured. For example, there is monotony, there is gentleness, a shape could give you, could excite you, and obviously there is an aggressiveness. So whatever you look at, you know, you There are many other categories, but obviously I decided to boil them down to four. So if something is monotonous, you will find that monotony is created because there's a particular shape. Gentle, you have the sensation of being gentle. An object is even a woman, a gentle, or exciting, you know, it depends upon the shape. And again, you know, it could be aggressive. So obviously, since I'm a bit of a mathematician, and engineering obviously can be analyzed into mathematics, I thought, why not look upon the emotional side, how it can be analyzed into mathematical algorithms. So I decided to try and have a go at this. So basically, you know, if you look at any object, even colorful, you know, a colorful object, it doesn't matter what it is. Let us start by saying it could be a straight line. Parts of it could be a straight line. Parts of it could be curvaceous, like in a circle. And part of it could be pointed, like in a spear. And part of it could be a wiggly line, like a curl or an S. And it would appear that the mathematical analysis of this is so simple. It's very simple. All you have to do is find the center of the curve. If you have anything, it could anything, what it matters, it doesn't matter. Look at part of it. But don't look at a wide area. Look at a very small zone, and that small zone will have a curve of some sort. Now, if it is a straight line, you'll find the straight line is basically part of a circle whose center is at infinity, a long way off the line. So obviously, that is monotonous. If you have a curve which is part of a circle, obviously the center of the circle is closer to the curve. Like when you make a compass, you know, you put the point of a compass at the center, you make a curve. That's the. So if the center comes closer to the curve and sticks on the same side, then that becomes gentle, that curve. If the center of the curve touches the curve, that becomes a point, and that is aggressive. Now, if I have an S-curve or a curl, a wavy, we call a wavy hair, you know, you'll find that the center of parts of the curve will jump over, cross over the line to the other side. That's why we call it a wave, a wavy. A wave, the center that makes the curve, jumps over, it alternates. And for example, a pair of lips, with a lot of lipstick on them, you know, you'll find that the curve has got center, which alternates on the side. So this is what creates emotion. It is not the scenario as we see it that we actually see. We process it. We process it looking for the centers within the curve. And if the centers stay on the same line, on the same side of the curve, it could be monotonous if it approaches a straight line. It could be gentle if it comes closer. And if it hits the point, if it hits the curve, it's a point and therefore it's aggressive. If the center alternates on the curve, crosses over a number of times, like a pair of lips, for example, the shape of a young woman, the shape of a sports car, it is this that makes it exciting. Obviously, it is very thrilling, you know, and believe me that, you know, when you look, for example, a man and a woman, by looking at their shape, you can tell their age, their faces that they go through. You can even tell whether a woman can have children or not. For example, a six-year-old young girl would have a straight-line shape. Obviously, she cannot produce any children. The shape tells you so. If you have a woman whose reproductive system is working very healthily, she will tell you about her shape.
Well, my mind went more to a sports car, I must say.
Well,
and I think that the sports car, the way you were describing the way these curves work, the sports car immediately came to mind, that kind of extremely exciting feeling you get when you see a beautiful design like that.
But a truck, for example, a charabanc, it's got straight-line curves.
Not quite as thrilling.
But if you have, for example, a spear or a pointed building or a corner with a sharp, which we do, I'm afraid that's aggressive. In fact, it has an effect on the mental health of the people living in them, you know? So that is an interest that need to be expanded.
No, I find it fascinating, the idea of using a Saussurean theory to look at a piece of engineering. I find really interesting. Engineering, which has been your life, is an enormous area. You've been involved in several of them, but how can the areas of engineering, how can one sort of classify the areas of engineering? What are the different main areas?
Well, engineering is, you are dealing with a situation where it could be small, like a family business, or it could be very big, like an international situation, you know. For example, oil drilling. Obviously, it needs management, but the actual sections that one can divide engineering is, you know, first you have a name, you have an imagination, and you imagine something. Anybody can do that. But then, you know, you have to research on it. So the first and foremost, I believe, is research and development on an intention or a name. Einstein once said, imagination is all. Imagination is much better than education. So obviously, I agree with him, you know, imagination is best. Once you imagine something, you have to research on it and develop it. So the first section, you need people who have brains in researching. These are people who can work on their own. They are not afraid of working in the unknown. The second section, I believe, once you research on something, you have to manufacture it. So you need a section of manufacturing. In this you have robotics, you have, you know, every section is so vast. But let's go through them. So once you manufacture something, you have something to sell, and you need installation. So you need contracting of a power station, for example. So you have research on a power station, you built it, and you install it. We've got two in Malta, and we are going to install another one. And then you have to maintain it. So you have a section on maintenance. These are the people who diagnose faults. If you, for example, need a power station, this is something that really, you know, needs a lot of effort to keep an entity, an engineering entity, working for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year without stopping. This is something that puts a headache on an engineer. Eh? An aeroplane has to cover the jumbo jet, for example, the Airbus 380. It does 13 hours non-stop. Those engine has to work. You have got 600 passengers. Guaranteeing is something that gives every engineer a headache, to guarantee your work, to work 24 hours a day for without stopping. So those are brains which needs organization. Then obviously another section is the operational side. The operational side is everything is going right, everything is working perfectly, but you have to operate it. You have to start it. You have to control it. You have to deliver your, let's say, electricity in this case, right? You have to operate the aircraft. You have to operate the navy. You have to operate the water production system in Malta. You have to operate the communication system in Malta. You have to operate the drainage system in Malta. We are people who work in the background. Nobody knows how we feel, you know. But the operation of Malta, for example, you have the port, you have the harbors, you have the free ports, all the airport. These are people who are coordinating the situation, you know. They're making sure that everything is working. And if it doesn't work, then the maintenance people have to come in as quickly as possible. Obviously, the operational people are very, very important. For example, you have an aircraft landing in the fog in the middle of London, for example. You know, every aircraft there, every 30 seconds. In fact, it's
mind-boggling.
It's mind-boggling, yeah?
That's true.
And obviously, you have the... Not many people have the last part. The last part is the apprenticeship system. You know, you have to train people for every branch. Every branch will have an educational system. So basically, those are the sections. But each section then have got a subsection with them. You have the management section within one. You have the people who shoulder the responsibility. The researchers, for example, in this case. Oh, you have the support staff, you have the cleaners, and you have, you know, the clerks. It is a vast situation, you know.
You've often spoken to me in the past about the importance of being able to look at a scenario, a situation, and to be able to extract from it information, which for obviously for an engineer is absolutely key. I mean, going back to something that you've been involved in, I know, the Gozo ferry, you've got a problem, perhaps, yes. And you have to, your diagnostic skills have to be very well honed, really.
Yes.
How do you go about extracting the information from the situation in which you find yourself?
This subject is vast. And I will not talk about myself for the time being, but I will talk about every individual. Every individual must learn to extract information from a scenario. Give an idea to the listeners what this really means. During the war, the average British pilot only flew 7 times, and he was dead. A flying ace used to probably live through shooting down 30 aircraft, and he was a flying ace. People who reached the 100 mark were very, very few. So here is a situation. I think the epitome of extracting information from a very fast scenario. You are chasing an aircraft during a war, or the aircraft is chasing you, he's going to kill you. And out of that scenario, you have to try and find a way out. If you have an aircraft, this is the same as driving a car, by the way. And hence, this is very important. In fact, I would like to introduce a test in our driving license, how a person extracts information from a scenario. In our case, obviously, the driving scenario. We don't do it, so we get killed. In the last few months, many people got killed in Malta. So, I've done about 400 deaths for the course in Malta. And every death is simply because the people cannot extract information from a scenario. Let's say, for example, you're driving, and the cars in front of you are all parked. Obviously, you are measuring distances. And by measuring distances in a static scenario, you cannot get killed. Same with an aircraft. You see, if you're flying an aircraft and the aircraft is right in front of you, heading in the same direction as you are, it's very easy to shoot it, because with respect to your aircraft, it's not moving. It's like seeing a picture on the wall. A picture on the wall, you are only measuring distances. And distances really cannot kill you. But now let's say you are at a T-junction, and you want to come out of this T-junction while driving your car. And you look to your right or to your left. You're looking to your right, for example. And you see a scenario. Well, if there are no cars coming, the road is static. So you are measuring only distances. And one slight glance is enough to measure a static scenario. But now, what happens if a car is coming towards you? And this car is not static. Well, I'm afraid one quick glance, like taking a photograph, a very quick photograph, will only extract distances information, the information on distance. If a car is coming towards you, you have to make at least two glances. Now here's the explanation. When you make the first glance, you see distances. By the way, you always measure distances with your eyes, with your sensor. By the way, don't measure with your eyes, you measure with your brains or your mind. The process does it. But anyway, if you are at a T-junction and you are looking to your right and you see a car coming towards you, now the process of looking is glancing, obviously. If you glance once and it's a quick glance, you can only see distances. And that will only give you static information. Now, you have to wait a little bit. There's time involved in it. And you make another glance. Now, the second glance, if the car was moving, it will give you a different distance. So, here is where the mind works. You have to have your mind in a good condition. It will process that information. It will subtract the first distance from the second distance. And if there's a difference, your brain will say, ah, there's something moving. So, you have extracted now information on velocity, which can kill you. I am going to call this the rate of change of the scenario. Unfortunately, this does not happen in art. Many people like artistic functions which are static. They cannot get killed. No art has killed anybody. You see? And the average artist and the average religious man people, they can only detect distances, unfortunately. But it's richer if you can extract, in this case, rate of change. Now, it's not enough sometimes. Sometimes you have to detect higher information, which is acceleration. Now, you can only detect acceleration in a scenario by looking at it three times. You say, the first distance will give you distance. The second distance will give you a different distance. The difference between the first distance and the second distance will give you the first velocity. If you look at it three times, you have another distance, right? And if there is a difference between the second and the third distance, you have a second velocity. And if the first velocity is different from the second velocity, you have acceleration. The brain does this.
It makes us sound very clever, but I said it's something we're doing all the time.
Yes. We don't glance, shall we say, incrementally. We make a long glance, a long look. So I would advise anybody to extract information on a higher order. Please look at something using a long glance. Don't look at it very quickly, because looking at it very quickly, you see a static picture. In fact, a photograph, a very fast camera, if you look at any aircraft traveling at 600 miles per hour, the photograph becomes static. So you have only static information. Please, when you drive, look at the information more than a glance.
So it's all about correct observation.
Correct observation, yes. Mm. And of the process of the brain. Huh? The brain is a wonderful thing. Please don't drive when you're tired, because the process slows down. Don't drive when you drink. And don't drive when you get older. There is the another element which we must talk about. It is the reflexes. When you are about 20 years old, your reflexes are about 0.3 of a second. When you get to middle age, it's about 0.5 of a second, and when you reach the age of 60, it is a 1 second delay. And in 1 second, a lot of things can happen. So these are the extracting of information. We don't teach it. And people during the war got killed because they did not know how to extract information from... But a pilot must do it very quickly, especially if it's warfare. And that's why people got killed. People got killed after 7 flights. The average man does not know how to extract information.
I can see that I'm going to have to ask you to come back on the program to discuss all the other things that we were thinking about. But just, I've had a lot of engineers on the research boat. This is the third in the series. And I've had a lot of engineers with me in the studio, and they've spoken about their research. And with great enthusiasm, I must say, many of them. Quite a few of them have spoken about the challenges of engineering research. And these challenges are various, but not only financial, although that's one of them. Just in the short period we have left, what do you feel are the main challenges for today's engineers when we're talking about the importance of research?
The main challenge these days is the growth. Going back 100 years, for example, you see, the average engineer, in fact, when I was young, I used to do it myself, the average engineer at his own home, he had the facilities and the financial means to do something himself. He could play about with radios. In my youth, I built plenty of radios, you know, and I did a lot of work on radio control systems, you know, which I enjoyed, you know. And therefore, the average man could handle the situation. If he was interested in mechanical engineering, for example, he could build a car, he could build a small engine, you know. So that sort of research was almost on a domestic level. Everybody could do it. That, I think, is wonderful. Unfortunately, I'm afraid it's not like that anymore. Unfortunately. Let's take electronics, for example. The size of electronics has gone down and down. In my days, we used to have, on the size of a fingernail, used to have one transistor. When I was at university, one of my students actually built a transistor, one transistor. But nowadays, on your fingernail, you can have a million transistor or 10 million transistor. No research on a domestic level or my home in Calcutta can do it. I haven't got the very expensive machinery to do it. So imagine today researching on computers. It's not a one-man job. Researching on computers means effectively going smaller, mathematics. It is a team. Nobody nowadays can do research on his own. If it's a, for example, an aircraft, the A330-380, it's not even one company anymore. It is a whole nation working with a whole nation. Imagine the Saturn rocket. Nobody would dream of doing anything at home. So now research has gone so big that any entity requires big organization, big brains, big preparations. But basically, it is teamwork. It's a team. If it's engineering we're talking about, you must have mathematics. In fact, I think mathematics is more powerful than engineering. If you say, let's take, for example, the hospital. An engineering concern producing a product for hospital. A hospital nowadays have got x-rays, ultrasound, MRIs. All this is mathematics. You see the intern of a person not by opening him up, but through recognizing the certain components, in engineering terms first, then you handle them with mathematics, and you put them together on a monitor to see the inside of a person. So can you imagine, before you make a car, every component you can see it. There were no really processing, a piston and a cylinder and a bearing and a wheel. Anybody could do it. But nowadays, when you think of a company which produces, shall we say, hospital equipment, the mathematics that goes into ultrasound, to see something that is in there, you cannot see it.
So it's not only teamwork amongst engineers.
No.
But it's different type of engineers that are specialized in this and that and the other, or specifically in mathematics or whatever. Even. So it's not only networking amongst yourselves, but also much wider than that.
Even artists, the ergonomics of something, even artists. I mean, you cannot have, for example, a sports car or a rocket or an aircraft really designed solely by an engineer. The beautiful thing about it is that arts and engineering go together, because if a sport car doesn't look right, its aerodynamics are not right, So this is the field. There are 25,000 people working together,
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to end up there. Thank you very, very much, Professor Charles Poulet, for coming on Research Matters today. And I hope there'll be another opportunity when we can continue our conversation and talk about some of the things we didn't manage to speak about today. Thank you so much. My guest today was Professor Charles Poulet. I do hope that you can join us again next week for another edition of Research Matters. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.